Welcome to the First Time Facilitator Podcast. Whether you're a first time facilitator or a seasoned pro, listen in for tips and tricks to make a bigger impact at the next workshop you deliver. And now, your host, Leanne Hughes.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Leanne Hughes, and I'm here to help you design fast to live strong without the stress. I don't know if I sound different. I'm actually lying down recording this in these recovery boots, these compression recovery boots. They look like Darth Vader. I ran 27 kilometers this morning training for the Gold Coast Marathon, which is unlike Fight Club. If you're training for a marathon, you tell everyone that you're training for a marathon. Anyway, that's why I might sound a little bit different as I record this intro. But I'm so excited to bring back this guest today, the rock star of consulting, the million-dollar consultant, Alan Weiss. This is the third time he's been on the show, and every episode, well, the previous two that he's been on have been just, you know, some of the most downloaded on YouTube and this podcast. And every time I talk to him, I feel like I'm metaphorically being poked in the eye because of just his interesting reframes and ways of thinking around facilitation, around workshops, and how we build our businesses as well. And also, I think ultimately, live a really great life. In this conversation today, we riff on various things, including speedy workshop design. This is probably the fastest workshop I've ever heard of in terms of how fast it was designed, how Alan gets an idea, senses demand, market demand for a service, and he, like, pretty much within 5 minutes turns it into an offer. So pretty much how he busts out of the overthinking, topics that consultants should really be helping their clients with as we navigate an ambiguous world. And we also had some listener questions pre-submitted. So thanks to Jan Keck, Prina Shah, and Joe Alulovich for submitting your questions. From time to time, you'll see me on the flip chart or on my LinkedIn profile asking people, hey, I've got this guest coming up. What would you like to ask them? So there's an opportunity to engage with the show that way. You can also engage by joining thousands of other facilitators in our free group on Facebook called The Flip Chart. Link to that is in the show notes. Link to everything Alan is offering is also in the show notes. And of course, his work, you can find all of it at alanweiss.com. Alan also endorsed my book, The 2-Hour Workshop Blueprint, which you can find at 2hourwork.shop, again, linked in the show notes. And yeah, I mean, this has been a really great journey working with Alan. I first spoke to him, the first ever conversation was on this podcast back in 2020. And since then, I've met him in Las Vegas, in Hawaii, and even brought him over to Brisbane 2 years ago to host a conference as well. How cool is that? It's amazing the power of podcasting and relationships around the world. Okay, let me know what you thought of this one. Share the love on social media, tag me, tag Alan, and enjoy the episode. Hey, Alan, they say good things come in threes, and this is your third time on the podcast. So welcome back again.
Well, thanks. Good things also come in six. So don't stop here.
Oh, great. I've got you on record saying that. So we've got another three more episodes to record. Hey, there's something interesting. I was reflecting on our first conversation. It really just blew up in the facilitation community. And you spoke about things like not being a generalist, charging on value, self-worth. And the other thing that you brought up was, at the time, I thought I was very successful because I was so busy delivering workshops. And you said to me that my business model was wrong. Why do you think that conversation was so popular?
Well, I think that people are very conscientious and they want to show that they're busy and that they have accountability and discipline. But the problem is they express that in tasks. They express that in deliverables. They express that in things. And you have to break away from that and understand that you're most successful when you're producing results for clients, whether the clients are coaching clients or advisory clients or workshop clients, doesn't matter. That's what it's all about. When you're involved in this high labor intensity delivering things, it can be very, very frustrating because you want to do a lot, but it means keeping increasing your labor intensity. And that just is wearing, you know?
It is. And I think, you know, you also shared that real wealth is discretionary time. And with this podcast, it's for the facilitation audience, people that deliver workshops. And it's almost like a client comes to you and you think the solution is a workshop because that's just what you're thinking about. I think since working with you over the last 4 years, there are like a billion different ways you can help a client get a result. So what do facilitators need to hear from you in terms of moving away from a workshop is the answer?
Well, let me tell you two things here. One is there's a zillion ways you can deliver a workshop that's better and not labor dependent. And I can give you an example from my own history, if you like.
Yeah.
And the second is that you're quite right in quoting me that there are all kinds of ways to quote to help a client without delivering a workshop, without sort of defaulting to what you've always done in the past. So on the second point, if you regard yourself as an expert, you control how your expertise is disseminated. And for a lot of people, workshop's the worst possible alternative. They don't learn well that way. It's confining. There's a dynamic in the room that can involve egos and politics and all kinds of things. And in the United States, at least, the workshop and training business is about a $60 billion annual industry. And they pretty fundamentally reject ROI. You know, in my approach is we have objectives, metrics, and value. They don't really have metrics. They don't want to be measured because they can't justify what they're producing. Mm-hmm. Now, let me tell you something around the first one I mentioned, which is there are a lot of different ways to do a workshop. In the early 70s, I was recruited by a firm in Princeton, which started my consulting career. I was spent 11 years with them, and I came in as this neophyte, and I left being in charge of Latin America and the Far East and North America at different times. But my first week or two there, I went through a training, the trainer program. The guy's name was Mitch Mitchell. I'll never forget. We had a beard, a big, soft-spoken guy. There were about 12 of us in the class, a couple of employees of the firm, the rest were clients. And Mitch conducted this two-week training program that was like a boot camp. And I said to myself quite quickly, I hope there's other things for me to do here because I can't do what he's doing. He was marvelous. Second nature, what we call now unconscious competency, just a slick, wonderful deliverer of education. And I said, I can never do that. So maybe I can get a job, you know, selling or something. Well, about 4 or 5 years later, I was regarded as the finest trainer in the United States. And even when I was an officer of the company, I just did once a quarter, I do the training, the trainer thing, and people would wait for me to do this. So what I'm saying to you is that in deconstructing this, the reason that I became so good was not that I tried to emulate what Mitch did, who was superb at what he did, but I realized there were different ways to do a workshop, and I started to build them around my strengths and personality. So we'd have interactive exercises. We wouldn't necessarily meet from 9 to 4. You know, we'd go to the hotel management where we were and say, give us some problems to work on. And so suddenly a new thing was born. So there's all kinds of options that we have we don't realize.
Yeah. And I think my mistake early on was I would see these amazing facilitators and just try and emulate them and do what they were doing. And it just didn't feel aligned or right. And that's why I was sort of spending so much time designing these things. There's Andrew Holloway was on the podcast and he shared a story where he met you in an elevator. I think, I don't know where you were in the world, but you were getting the lift down to the workshop and you were writing something down on a piece of paper. And Andrew's like, hey, just like, what are you doing? And you're like, oh, I'm writing up the workshop. Like, in the elevator down to the workshop. I mean, is that a true story? Do you design on the fly?
There's a joke in my family and my community that I have a more detailed workshop when I stay on the upper floors of a hotel because the elevator takes longer to get to the bottom. and I'll tell you another truth. I mean, a lot of things I just riff, a lot of things that I just do extemporaneously, but you have to be fearless. The very first time I did a program called Six Figures to Seven Figures was in Las Vegas. I had 40 people. I paid $5,000 each, right? Do the math. And as I walk into the room, you know, at 8:30 in the morning, I looked at the people in there and I looked at these yellow legal notes I had and I said, it's not going to work.
Oh,
and
really?
I threw them in the garbage and I did the whole thing extemporaneously. Now, you might say you need a lot of courage to do that with, you know, $200,000 in the room. But I don't think I had all that much courage. I think I just said to myself, this is not the most important thing in the world, and I might as well take some risks and make sure I do it right.
Mm.
That's why, and you know this perfectly well, I refuse to look at any kind of smile sheets, feedback sheets, any kind of sheet, because I don't care. I show up, I do the best I do, and I go home. And I teach the top third of the class. Everybody else had better run along and catch their breath. But I won't slow down really fast learners because some people aren't learning as fast or they're on their cell phones. I think we all have to be our own person doing these things with the common agreement that we've got to make this as effective as possible for the people sitting in the seats.
Mm. I think that goes back to your point around being the expert. I think some people that listen to this program, you know, they might maybe just starting out and delivering different models of different thought leaders, stuff that they haven't created themselves. And so they kind of need to do that research to be able to prepare for that. But when you're going in, you're delivering on the go spontaneously, you're delivering your own content that you've brewed up for the last 30 to 40 plus years.
Don't go too far there, but yes.
I was going to say, you know, I'll stop at 40. Let's talk about that point around delivering to the top third of the room. And I think there's a real push for accessibility and a lot of accountability on the person to like help the people like get the knowledge. But there is also some accountability from the people in the room to step up as well. Do you see it as shared accountability? Like, how do you justify the top third?
The two thirds of the class that aren't in the top third are quite able to huff and puff and run along. They might not learn as much as the top third, but they're going to learn a hell of a lot. As opposed to my settling for a mediocre level where the top third gets bored and they don't contribute. And the middle says, yeah, okay, this is a good speed. And the bottom third's still running to catch up. So my feeling is I'm obligated to give my very best effort and to force people to be challenged. I'll also tell you, in line with what you just said, that when you attend any kind of event or experience, your obligation is to learn. My obligation is to present information, in my case, as entertainingly and with as much information and power and originality as I can. But the participant responsibility is to be in a mental and emotional set where they are willing to accept it. And so their ego isn't such that they have to try to be the second smartest person in the room, challenging everything. Their ego isn't such that they're trying to impress their colleagues in the room. And their mental preparedness is such that they don't have to keep checking their email and sending pictures back of the room setup. So I feel this is a consensus agreement, a tacit consensus agreement. And I've said to people, you know, look, if you don't want to be here, I don't give a damn, leave.
You just say that to people.
Oh yeah. I got up a group of 50 financial executives. They all got their cell phones out, you know, because somebody left, they got applause, and I came in and I said to them, okay, look, here's the first thing. I'm gonna be with you for another 59 minutes and never again. Probably never see each other again. So you can listen to me for 59 minutes and figure out why I was invited to be here and paid the fortune that I am. Or you can fiddle with your cell phones and you'll never know what happened. I don't care. Now, let's begin.
That's cool. I don't know if I'd be brave enough to say that. I love that, though. You know, that's being fearless.
I think it's honest. And I mean, yeah. I could have said to their boss, tell them to leave their cell phones outside, put them in a basket. Everybody would have resented that. They would have felt like they were being treated like children. I gave them a choice. You can listen or not, but just understand what the repercussions are.
Yeah, that's good. I like that priming. Something that I wrote down here is I've been to many of your workshops, and not only do you do workshops, but you really host learning experiences. I don't know what it's called that you host in New York City, but you do it's like a mastermind. Then you take your groups to a Broadway show. You get orchestra seating. How has that evolved?
Well, I did, one thing I do is the Hall of Fame. There are about 40 people right now in the Hall of Fame, and, you know, maybe 14 will sign up for this and so forth. But I also do it sometimes with some workshops I do. Like I did something once called New York, New York, actually. My feeling is that, people just went crazy over this eclipse. I thought it was a big nothing. You know, you stare up at this thing in the sky. Maybe you see the shadow, maybe you don't. The sun is bright. Mm-hmm. And the media hype it, and everybody's out there doing this. And I wrote on my forums today, you know, I've stood on the Great Wall of China. This morning when I went to work out, there were three deer in my driveway. You know, we're expecting a fourth grandchild. These are the experiences of life. That's staring up at the moon, which has been there for 40 million years, and saying, oh my God, it casts a shadow. I mean, it's like looking at the damn groundhog in the United States waiting for six more weeks of winter. My feeling is that you have to be socialized in the world. And so what I want to do is I want to take people to excellent restaurants and show them how the hell to use silverware. I want to take them to Broadway shows they would never otherwise have seen and show them the kind of talent that's on that stage and what the playwright had in mind. I had a note the last time I did this from a guy, very successful military officer in my program for a long time, very innovative. And he said, Alan, I never would have attended that play if he hadn't taken us. Mm. And he loved it. So I think it's important for people to understand how to get along in the world and what kind of power they really have. Because if you know the rules of the game, quote unquote, you know how to act, you have tremendous power. And the problem is too many people cede their power, C-E-D-E. They let their power go. Mm. And that's no way to wield influence.
Yeah. And I think that was probably the major call out from our first conversation was being a peer of the buyer and not being a subordinate. And probably one of my, there's so many things I could just go on from there. One thing I do want to just call out, this isn't a question, more of a comment, but what I love about alansforums.com, one of my favorite threads in there is the what to watch, the TV thread. And it's just nice to, it's so refreshing that you as a thought leader, you have interests outside of what you do. And I think many of the communities I join, you just focus on like whatever their niche is and the expertise, but like we're humans, like we enjoy other things outside of work. So yeah.
Well, look at the forums. I have a board on their sex, religion, and politics.
Yeah.
You know, I have a board on life balance and hobbies that people have. They're always talking about places they visited and cars they have and meals they've had and so forth. So I think, you know, you've heard me say this, you don't have a business life and a personal life. You just have a life.
Back to the experiences. What I love about also on the forums is you'll see people chatting about something and within 5 minutes, you've already generated a workshop and a live event based on the conversation. Now, many listeners here have like, you know, they're out walking their dogs and thinking, oh, I've got a, I'm actually talking about myself. I've got a great idea for a workshop. Maybe I'll run it in next year and I'll think about what it's about and I'll write up the copy. It'll take me 2 weeks. What is your process from going from I'm seeing a demand here through then just putting something up to the world to sell?
Well, it's ironically selfish. I was dealing with one of my longtime clients and she was having problems with something. I said to her, the problem is you keep saying to yourself, how can I help this person? I keep saying to myself, what's in it for me? And that's a fundamental difference as a starting point. Yeah. So my way isn't selfish, but unless there's something in it for me, some reciprocity, I'm not passionate about it. You know, I'm not, there's a great line, a humorist by the name of George Ade said this. He said, don't pity the martyrs. They love the work, right? I wish I had written that. So I find that, here's a recent example. One of my clients I was talking to on Zoom like this, and I was talking about community because I have this global community. She said, you know, that should be your next book, How You Build Communities. And, you know, I have a workshop on that topic too. In fact, I'm going to be running one in May here. And so I did my usual thing. I whined, you know, I said, oh, that'll never work, I said. And then later on, I had a drink and I'm sitting down and I said, well, so I ran it by my publisher. My publisher says, I love that idea. I said, well, I'm glad I thought of it, you know. And so the book comes out, you know, later this year. I'm just finishing it this morning. So I try to look at what I'm told and ask myself, is this something I would love doing and I'm passionate about and it will build my brand and it will enable me to interact with people who I love to interact with and it will help a whole lot of folks. If that's the case, it's probably worth pursuing. If the next day I look at it and I say, why the hell did I write this down? Then I just toss it.
Thank you for being so honest and saying it is for selfish reasons. There's one of my offerings that I deliver. It's my favorite thing ever. It's the red carpet experience. And I think it came out of we had a growth cycle conversation. You shared that as well. And I basically took myself to a cafe and said, what would I be over the moon to deliver? And it was, you know, drinking champagne, post-it notes on a rooftop. And that, you know, came up with that. And I think just from working with you and seeing you role model that has been like so good rather than like, oh, I should be doing this because people want this. The what you just shared is something, one of the philosophies is speed is more important than content. And so that was an example, right? You had that Zoom call, you get on the phone to the publisher, now you've got this book coming out. A lot of the people that listen to the show that I talk to are stuck in this sort of overthinking cycle. What's a way of breaking out of that?
Stop worrying about being judged. I'm asked this question a lot. People are afraid to do things because they think somebody's going to judge them. And that they'll be critiqued and it will hurt their image or their ego will suffer. And if they're that fragile, their ego probably will suffer. I think what you have to do is simply say, I'm going to see how this goes. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Because I have news for you. We can't really progress unless we also fail. Nobody progresses on a series of victories. You just get stale. So you have to fail. You have to get a shock once in a while. And that's what resilience is all about. You bounce forward. So I think that it's great to try things. I mean, we've been talking about the stuff I've done that works. You know, there's a raft of stuff I've tried that didn't work at all. And I thought it was the greatest idea in the world. But, you know, unless you try it, you don't know.
Yeah, and I've seen that, like in a forum, like you put something out there, no one's, you know, you might have had a couple of bites, but you haven't got the critical mass and you've actually acknowledged it and thrown either another offer or just said it's not happening.
Yeah, because it's not a comment on my personal worth that I offered something that didn't work. You know, my successes are greater than my failures, thank God. So I have some credibility. But I don't think you have much credibility if you don't acknowledge the fact that you've failed and you learn from it.
Yeah. When we were in Hawaii, we were lucky enough, we had 2 half-day sessions with you and we recorded them on audio. And I actually took one of your statements here, which really struck me in Hawaii. And I think it also applies to a lot of people listening to this show around clarity, you know, the word clarity and how we're always waking up trying to find the silver bullet, the answer. And you said, stop the crazy search for clarity. Life is about mid-course corrections. If you can live in ambiguity, you can be happy. How do we get better at navigating ambiguity, especially in the world that we live in now?
Well, I think there are a couple of things you can do. First thing is ambiguity is neutral. It's not bad. It's not good. It's just ambiguous. And it means, you know, you're not sure what's around you. There are a lot of people who write books on clarity. They pride themselves on creating clarity. That's a lot of crap, you know. The Titanic, I don't care what, it could not create clarity. It couldn't see the iceberg. And even ships with radar and everything else can't always create clarity. And so you have to be light on your feet and be willing to deal with the hand you're dealt at the moment. So I would say that understand that nobody's shooting at us, that few things are fatal. And so if you're going to walk into the fog, it's not like there's a cliff there or people shooting at you. You just have to feel your way and be confident that you can get out of it. And people follow people who are confident. They follow people, you know, basically that's the essence of charisma. You know, I trust her. I'm following her. So you can't fear ambiguity. And in fact, I can make a case, just as I made a case, that disruption and volatility should be offensive weapons. Create it, you know. I disrupted consulting for solos when I created value-based fees in consulting instead of hourly billing. I think you can also create ambiguity by people not knowing what you're going to do next. And if you look at Amazon and Jeff Bezos, that's exactly what the hell he does. You know, suddenly he buys a food company, right? He's going to drop things by drones. I mean, he started as a bookseller. And now you can buy tires from the damn company or flowers. It doesn't matter. And so the more ambiguity you create, the harder it is for people to anticipate what you're going to do. And therefore, you usually can rule the market.
That's a great way of doing it. I had a friend that said to me, we've been friends for quite a few years. And she's like, Leanne, I don't know what you do. I said, that's okay. All I want you, you know, if you were to refer me to someone, all I want you to do is just say, hey, Leanne's a great person. You like her energy. Like, you should have a conversation. And I think I'm okay with that. But when I spoke to you 4 years ago, I was like, no, Alan, I need to be very specific with what I offer. And you actually said to me, but wouldn't you be bored by that if you just did the one thing? And I think a lot of facilitators, like, they have like this zone of, like, we're just taught, we're trained that we need to have this niche and just focus on one thing. But a lot of us are multi-potentialites and we have different interests. So,
yeah. That's very true. I just, like, you have tremendous energy, right? You have sky high energy. And the key for people who have great energy is not to fritter it away on too many things. I mean, you can do several things, you know, but if you're trying to do 1,000 things, you don't have enough energy to do that. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we think we can walk on water, you know, we can do anything, and suddenly our knees are wet. So I think that energy is incredibly powerful. And I think if you can channel it in 3 or 4, often synergistic kind of directions, you'll rule the roost.
Cool. Thanks. Good reminder for me, actually. I've been taking a lot on at the moment. Hey, Jan Keck on LinkedIn has a question for you. And he said, what has changed about how consultants find new clients in the last 5 years?
In the last 5 years? Well, yeah. What's changed for the worst, let me start with that, is that consultants and most professional service providers feel that the internet is the way to market, and social media is the way to market, more specifically LinkedIn is the way to market. There is more crap on LinkedIn than in a manure field, all right? I called this guy to task for talking about that he can create a $25,000 a day consulting company for anybody who wants one. And he got to me privately and he said, why don't we talk and compare notes? I said, I don't chat with people. You know, you join my programs or not. And he said, well, then stop saying bad things about me. And I said, listen, when you want to say things in public, expect public feedback. So I think that one of the bad things that's changed is that people feel like they can market easily and cheaply by doing it on the internet. And that's totally wrong, because the research shows over the last 10 years that executives buy on a peer-to-peer basis. All right. If you look at Jonah Berger's work at Wharton, you'll see all of this laid out. I think what's changed for the better is that consultants can credibly deal with people remotely on Zoom, which I don't consider the internet. I consider that a different form of communication. Can market on Zoom, can even conclude a sales agreement on Zoom, and to some extent can even deliver on Zoom if they choose to. So the wear and tear of travel and of having to sit in meetings and clients, which is the worst in the world, all that's pretty much been obviated. You know, when I started, there were about 235,000 consultants in the United States, but, you know, you're talking 300 million people. And there were big A firms. And there was no internet. So today you have like a big 2.5 firms. The rest are gone.
Yeah.
You know, McKinsey's still here and so on.
Yeah.
You probably have 4 or 5 times that many independent consultants, because a lot of people left corporate settings to try to go out on their own, most of them unsuccessfully. But people in my community are making a lot of money and a very good living and fulfilling their goals, as you know, because if you have a structured discipline approach, you can do this. And I'd say to the person who asked this question, just listen to what we were talking about earlier. And that is, if you want to be successful today as a consultant, and what's changed in the last 5 years, let's say pandemic and post-pandemic, is that you create disruption, you create volatility, you create uncertainty, you create ambiguity, and people will come to you for help. If you tell people to stick their heads in the sand, then the result is going to be that they're going to be stagnant and they're not going to grow.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess so much in there as well. And I agree with you on the pros and cons. And LinkedIn, while it is, yeah, you're right, it is a bit of a cesspool.
Well, today, this morning, sorry, 14 leadership rules that you should never ignore. Make a mistake twice. Treat people the way you'd like to be treated. I mean, God, it's just platitudes. I mean, it's utter stupidity.
I've seen them. I've grown. I've just sort of scrolled on. What you said there is, like, I agree. Like, there's so many people that are leaving their jobs right now and becoming independent consultants. Maybe they think it's an easy thing to do, or, you know, I get a lot of people that reach out to me and they said, oh, hey, I'm starting my consulting business. So apart from recommending your book and, you know, getting started in consulting, how do they sort of hit the ground running when they start this new thing? Considering I think there is more competition now because it is more accessible for people to do it.
Well, yes, I spent 11 years at that firm in Princeton, and then I became president of a firm up here where I got fired. But I learned consulting on somebody else's dime. It's not so easy to do that anymore. A boutique firm probably wouldn't take you in today as easily or as readily, and especially not in a marketing capacity. What most people have to learn is marketing. They know the rest.
Yeah.
So I would suggest, you know, even with my books, nobody learns to ski by reading a book. You need a coach. And not somebody in the chalet sipping brandy, somebody up on the slopes with you. So they have skiing in Australia, don't they?
We do. Not world class.
Not a lot of high mountains, right? So anyway, I think that you should get yourself a coach. And a coach is somebody who's been there and done that. And you might think, well, it's an investment. I have to make money. The fact is, it's the kind of investment that will make you a load of money if you do it right. But if you don't do it right, you'll repeat the same mistakes over and over and over, or you'll listen to the same people who are giving you advice just to take money from you. So what you said about there are more people trying to be consultants than ever before, the thing that everyone has to remember is competition opens markets. It doesn't narrow markets. It opens markets. So like when I said nobody understands marketing, they need to understand these tenets. So Burger King builds burger joints across the street from McDonald's because they know people go there to buy burgers. You know, if you go, I don't know what it's like in Sydney and Melbourne, because I've never looked for cars when I've been in those cities. But if you look for a car, say in San Francisco, Van Ness Street is lined with auto dealerships. Any kind of car you want. You want a Bentley, you want a Maserati, you want a Ford, you want whatever. They're all there because they know people go on that street to buy cars. So they all have joints there. So people are looking for consulting help every day because companies have reduced the numbers of people working for them. They're relying more on technology and AI and so forth and so on. The delivery companies, FedEx and UPS, I don't know about DHL, just had big layoffs, but they laid off white-collar people. They didn't lay off delivery people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think consultants, especially solo consultants, are more in demand than ever. But you have to create a brand. People have to know you're there. It goes back to what you said earlier. You have to be original, have your own intellectual property.
Yeah. And another thing you said to me, our group in Hawaii, is being an object of interest creates interest. So sometimes I find, even just sharing, like, I asked you about car advice and things like that, and that it makes you interesting. And, you know, the way that you live is a lot of your appeal. Like, people want your lifestyles. And that, I guess, that's intentional in your marketing.
Yeah, that's why I'm not bashful about marketing my lifestyle.
Yeah.
I mean, if it annoys you, you know, don't listen to me, don't read my stuff. But you have to be an object of interest to others. You know, a brand is really what a brand means. It's how people think about you when you're not around. And so you want the kind of brand where people know who you are, they think about you. And when the right opportunity comes up, they say, okay, now I can use her. Now I can use him.
Mm-mm. You mentioned AI before. Of course, we've had a question from Joe Lilovich around AI. I'll just read it out to you. She said, the tension between AI and made by a human. One message is that you have to use AI or you get left behind. The other is you have to be as human as possible, showing you created it with original thought, as people want the human touch. How do we reconcile this? Just do as much as possible of both.
I have a very easy answer to this.
Okay.
In 1982, John Nesbitt wrote Megatrends. So a lot of people listening right now weren't even born in 1982. But that was the first of the forecast books. And Nesbitt said in that book, high tech, high touch, and he was absolutely right. And he's still right today, you know, 45, 50 years later. And so the point is that AI is a tool, even regenerative AI. It's not going to take over the world. If you read things that have been through ChatGPT, I mean, you just have to sit back and giggle, right? If I said to you, hey, I want to invite you to a party, and I put it through ChatGPT, it would say, there's an intent to spend time with you at a celebratory affair. The question is how, and on it goes. I mean, yeah. It's boring.
Yeah.
I see some consultants' newsletters, which are obviously put through ChatGPT, yeah. And they come across as pretentious crap.
Yeah.
So you need high tech and high touch, and you should do both. So, you know, I have a cell phone. I use it to good advantage, but I also have a file of fax, a paper calendar, which I keep in my briefcase or on my desk. And I use it to know when I need to talk to people. And I believe that before I email someone, a client or a prospect, I call first. I prefer a call or a Zoom and not email. So that's high touch and less high tech. On the other hand, if I'm just answering questions, I can do high tech. I can answer them by email. What you and I are doing right now for your listeners is a combination of both.
Yeah, I like that. It's mainly sort of like an augmented thing. I'll link to that book in the show notes. So thanks, Alan. You wrote an email, your Monday morning memo. You went to see Billy Joel and he's on top of his game. That sounded amazing. We've got a question there about the aging generation. So this has come from Preena Shah, who you know in Brisbane. You've been on a podcast. She said there's an upcoming mass exodus of baby boomers from the workplace coming soon. Most workplaces know about it, but haven't adequately prepared. What advice does Alan have for organizations to prepare for this upcoming change? Why does he think it hasn't been given much attention?
What hasn't been given much attention because people don't really understand demographic change. They think it takes place over long periods of time. In about 7 years, in around 2030, the United States, again, right now we have about 340 million people, whatever. In 7 years, the United States will have more people over 65 than children. That is unprecedented. Mm-hmm. In Australia and the US and Canada, Western Europe, yet even China, morbidity is outpacing fertility. And so we're not replacing ourselves. So that means you might say three things have to happen. Now, one thing is we need intelligent immigration, if that's not an oxymoron. We need intelligent immigration. The United States in particular has been built on immigration, you know? The second thing is we need to use technology intelligently, which can replace people in a lot of different positions. But the third thing, guess what, is we have to utilize the aging aspects of our population, yeah. Because age and aging are two different things. Mm-hmm. And so age is simply a chronological number. Now, I've never heard of anybody who, say, 27 called wise. They have wisdom. No, you say that about people who've been around for 30, 40 years. Retirement, as you know, I think is a ludicrous, you know, fiction. You might leave a job that you're in, but you shouldn't leave your contribution to the environment around you. And so as people get older, whether they choose to leave an organization or they're forced to leave it, which would be a shame, just like pilots are forced to stop flying at 65, just when they know everything about flying. They've been through lightning strikes. They've been through engine failures. And oh, sorry, you have to go. You're 65. So we have to get over this ageism kind of thing we have. You know, there are parades for minorities. There are parades for this, parades for that. There's no parades for older people. There are no protests for older people. But the fact is, we desperately need that kind of intelligence because they've been around the block. So Billy Joel is 74. He's in the best voice I've ever heard him. I'm 78, and I am on top of my friggin' game, you know? I have my 66th, the 7th book coming out in a few months, and I'm thinking about what to do next. Now, I'm an entrepreneur, so I don't have to worry about an age restriction, but I think anybody has to capitalize on the fact that they've got huge experience, and now, if they just want to sit and tend to the flower bed, that's okay. But, you know, believe me, sooner or later, you get tired of looking at flowers, too.
Yeah. I'm with you. And it's so great to see you just on top of your game and just with your energy. It's so inspiring. I never want to retire. I want to sort of keep, you know, innovating and doing what you're doing. So keep it up, Alan.
Well, you're the only person I know. I can say this honestly, even with this huge community, you're the only person I know who speaks faster than I do.
Yeah, we'll have to slow, people listening will have to slow this podcast down to 0.6, 0.7 when they listen in.
Well, see, I didn't drink this afternoon at all because I knew I had to pay attention to understand what you were saying.
I love it. Oh, cool. So I can match you pace for pace. That's good.
Yes, you can.
Lovely. One more thing I want to, because you talked about aging and how you're innovating and doing things like that. I think one of my favorite models from you is the success trap where you get plateaued, then you got to jump to the next one. But often we don't recognize that we're at the plateau or it takes too much energy to jump at a different time. Can you just share that model? I think it's very relevant for a lot of people listening in because everyone, there comes a time in two or three years where you're like, what's next? And you kind of feel that ambiguity that we were talking about earlier. Can you just briefly share that model and why it's important for people to consider?
Well, this is called S-curve theory, and I don't know who on earth invented it. It's like looking to see who invented a double axis chart. I don't know.
Yeah.
But S-curve theory means if you think about an S, at the very bottom, capital S, you start something new and you move slowly. Startups take a while. But then if you really grow, you have a strong curve up on the left hand of the S, and then the S curves in before it turns around and goes up again. What you have to do is you have to leap when that S plateaus at the top, because otherwise you're going to erode. In other words, you'll be on a plateau where you think you're doing just fine, but all plateaus erode because of the laws of entropy. Consequently, you know, when people start coasting, I got news for you. The only way you coast is down. Nobody can coast up. If you want to go up, you have to climb. Mm-hmm. So what you have to do is jump to the next S curve when you have maximum acceleration. If you look at IBM today, it stands for, you know, IBM stood for International Business Machine. And then they did punch cards and all this kind of crap. And they got into big trouble. And then they brought in Lou Gerstner, who was from, I think, the food industry. And Gerstner turned them around because he was a brilliant leader. And so IBM makes most of its profit today from consulting. So IBM, Gerstner got them to jump the S-curve. And so, you know, we're not about punch cards. We're not about hardware. We're not about software. We're about helping people transfer information. It's like Dyson. Dyson's not in the vacuum cleaning business. They're in the air movement business. So we have to be careful because if we get on that plateau, we're going to start to erode and go downhill. And there's a feeling of coasting that you think is speed, but it's really decline. And so, you know, here's my mantra. Companies cannot exist for long unless they continually grow. And companies cannot grow unless they innovate. And so the key for all consultants right now, in my opinion, is to help organizations to learn how to grow by innovation. And that will take care of any ambiguity. It will take care of market competition because not enough organizations are constantly innovating because they don't want to take the risk. And so we can help.
Yeah, one of the great examples I think you gave about innovation, I think you were working with Merck and you brought an award for the best idea that didn't work.
Algon, yeah, the best idea that did.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, to sort of make it feel like there is no fear because that's you're right. That's the thing that prevents innovation is like risk and fear of it failing. Alan, what should us as consultants look forward to in the next 12 months?
I think you're going to find that the world has become sort of inured to wars. You know, there are two major wars right now, to discrimination. There's all kind of ethnic discrimination going on in China and the Middle East. And to plague, I mean, it's almost like the four horsemen, you know, pestilence and plague and so forth. You know, we've lived through the microbes. We've lived through COVID. I think people are going to say, okay, this is life today. And there's a lot of money around. People became very prudent after COVID. And the people who best got through COVID, individuals and companies, had cash. So I think we're going to see this cash freed up. And we're already starting to see some of it in tourism. People are traveling more than ever before. If you get on an airplane today, my experience is most of the people on board are not business people. They're tourists. They're traveling somewhere to vacation, to family events, whatever it happens to be. So I think there's a lot of money that's going to be looking for a purpose to be spent. And I think that consultants should think about building their brand so they're known for something. They're known for their value. And they're not just somebody out there who says, oh, yeah, I can help you. That means you have to, you know, innovation for a consultant is continuing to produce original intellectual property. So whether it's a book or a podcast or it's a video or it's a speech, it's a workshop, whatever it is, you've got to get out there and show that you're unique and different. In my accelerant curve, this would be the vault.
Yeah.
And you'll find that there's business, a lot of business. I was talking to somebody the other day in Germany. You know, Germany's got a horrible economy right now. They're stalled. It's terrible. However, I said to him, look, Germany's the biggest economy in Europe. For the love of God, there must be a lot of companies doing well. He said, well, there are. I said, go after them. You know, don't sit around bemoaning the find a way to go to those companies that are doing well and have money. That's the standard.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, if you want to market as being someone that can help companies innovate, you've got to market innovatively. And so, Alan, just a funny thing, I bought this self-flying camera. So I basically throw it in the air and it tracks me as I walk. I was loving it. I had it for 3 days and I was like, oh, this is the best ever. I did something very stupid. I took it to the dog park, and I think you might know where this is going. So I've thrown this camera in the air, and this golden retriever has just, you know, run from 100 meters and just leapt out and ate my $800 camera. Anyway, I bought another one, and I'm like, I'm going to make $10,000 from this camera just through it being so innovative.
How do you retrieve the camera?
Yeah, it's sensor. So it flies, and then I just put my hand out, and it flies back into my hand.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And I think, like you said, my brand is about trying new things and being a step ahead. And so that camera sort of reflects that. But I think it's going to be worth the investment. I just got to be more careful. Funny thing is, the dog belonged to one of my clients. So that was a bit awkward. I couldn't get any worse. Anyway, Alan, you got your website, alanweiss.com. Where else can we send people if I'd like to connect with you?
Well, alanweiss.com would be great. Also, I have Monday Morning Memo, which comes out every Monday. I have A Minute with Alan, which is a minute video every weekday. And I have some really excellent, unique kind of things coming up. I'm doing this Zoom session on how you create value for existing clients and new clients and past clients, which people have trouble expressing. They just try to get repeat business rather than new business. Mm-hmm. That's a Zoom session. If people go to my site, they'll find a lot of free resources that they can access. You don't have to spend a dollar, and I think it'd be enjoyable. I'm also the latest NAF guy. Like, look, these are orders. I decided I wanted to reach people who can't normally afford most of the things I do, you know, after my free stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a $100 workshop, and this $100 workshop is on what I just talked about, adding value to existing and prospective clients for $100. And so I think I have people from 7 countries.
What?
I mean, I'm not trying to sell you anything, but it's probably the least expensive thing I've ever done.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I think it's good that you've got sort of different price points for people to find your work and, you know, interact with you as well. I've been a member of your programs for now 4 years since that interview. I mean, my whole life has changed because of working with you in a great way. So Alan's always a delight. Thank you for being a guest on the show. And we'll chat to you soon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.